This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents A Girl's Guide to Joining the Resistance, A Feminist Handbook on Fighting for Good, by Emma Gray, read by Andy Arndt. Introduction. On the evening of November 22, 1909, several thousand garment workers squeezed into Cooper Union's Great Hall in New York City. The crowd was almost all women, many still in their teens. They were there to discuss the poor working conditions that plagued their industry. Low wages, inhumane hours, abusive and unsafe environments, and whether they should call for a general strike among shirtwaist makers. This meeting was the culmination of a series of smaller strikes organized by female labor activists, several of which had led to arrests and violence against the picketing workers. The speakers slated for that evening included labor leaders such as the American Federation of Labor's Samuel Gompers, the Women's Trade Union League's Leonora O'Reilly, and B. Feigenbaum of the Jewish Daily Forward. One after another, they expressed solidarity with the shirtwaist makers, talking at length about the terrible conditions the workers experienced, while failing to offer concrete actions. Eventually, a slight 23-year-old Ukrainian Jewish woman named Clara Lemlich, erroneously described by reporters as a teenager, despite already being an experienced organizer, could stand it no longer. "I want to say a few words," she yelled out, before delivering a short, powerful speech in Yiddish. "I have listened to all the speakers. I would not have further patience for talk, as I am one of those who feels and suffers from the things pictured. I move that we go on a general strike." And they did. The next morning, 15,000 shirtwaist makers went on strike. By night, that number had grown to 20,000. Some estimate that as many as 40,000 shirtwaist makers eventually joined the movement. This strike, known alternately as the Uprising of the 20,000 and, my personal favorite, the Revolt of the Girls, gave energy to the organizing efforts of women garment workers across the country. Within the year, thousands of women workers had gone on strike, from Philadelphia to Chicago. The 11-week-long Uprising of the 20,000 didn't get the strikers all of their demands, but it did result in concrete progress. 339 waist and dress manufacturers signed contracts granting shorter work weeks, paid holidays, wage negotiations, and a promise not to discriminate against unionized workers. In 1954, Lemlich, who remained an activist throughout her life, gave an interview about her early days as a labor organizer. "What did I know about trade unionism?" she said. "Audacity. That was all I had. Audacity." The 2016 presidential election felt, in some ways, like a referendum on the value of women, and people of color, and immigrants, and refugees, and Muslims. The list goes on. One that we had lost. On the evening of November 9th, I walked in a daze under the gray, drizzly haze that seemed to permeate New York City to meet three friends, all women who shared my single-minded desire to sit in a cozy, dark corner and plot the resistance. Or at the very least, feel a modicum of usefulness. En route to the meetup, I passed Cooper Union, which stands just around the corner from my office, the site of Clara Lemlich's speech, the place where she had refused to be silent and allow inaction 107 years before. In the months following the presidential election, I found myself thinking a lot about women like Clara. Women who had the audacity to speak out and organize for change, before it was possible to rally the masses with a viral hashtag or even cast a vote at the ballot box. American history is filled with women who slowly but surely transformed the country. But since men's stories are the ones that tend to dominate our history books, we hear less about the contributions of these extraordinary women. Women such as civil rights leader Diane Nash, who co-founded the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and was instrumental in organizing sit-ins and freedom rides to protest segregation in the South. Or Sarah and Angelina Grimke, white Quaker sisters and abolitionists, who were the first women to testify on the issue of Black American rights before a state legislature. They spent much of their lives speaking publicly against slavery, even debating men, something that was nearly unheard of at the time. Or Sylvia Rivera, who at the age of 17 was one of the drag queens who fought back against police when they came to raid the Stonewall Inn, helping start the seminal 1969 Stonewall riots. According to the New York Times, as the riot began, Sylvia yelled, "I'm not missing a minute of this. It's the revolution." Or human rights and anti-racism activist and author Grace Lee Boggs, the daughter of Chinese immigrants, who grew up to adopt the teachings of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and hosted Malcolm X at her Detroit home. As OG feminist icon Gloria Steinem once said, "Power can be taken, but not given. The process of the taking is empowerment in itself." Each one of these trailblazing women took power where none was bestowed. Today, women are getting to watch that process of the taking play out right in front of their eyes, necessitated by a political moment that is distinctly hostile to women's rights. Women are leading the resistance, from the courts to the streets to Hollywood to the halls of Congress. Senators such as Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Kirsten Gillibrand are persisting like the nasty women they are. Alicia Garza, Opal Tometi, and Patrice Cullors, the women behind Black Lives Matter, are channeling their movement's energy into combating an administration's open disdain for black and brown lives. Women's March national co-chairs Carmen Perez, Tamika Mallory, Linda Sarsour, and Bob Bland are turning the massive energy the world witnessed on January 21, 2017, into a movement with true staying power. And it's not just the most visible leaders of this resistance that matter. Not only has progressive activism surged overall since November 2016, but women are more likely than their male counterparts to write and call Congress, march and protest, and express an intention to get more involved in the coming years. American women of all ages are showing up and doing the work and giving a fuck. This book is for the women and girls who give all the fucks, because there have always been women and girls who did. Women and girls who showed up to fight for their own inalienable rights and the rights of others. This book is for every woman who has chosen to give a fuck, despite the odds being stacked against her. I learned so much from listening to the women I spoke to while writing this book. I hope these pages can serve as a beginner's guide to getting involved, or at least a crash refresher course. Writing it certainly was for me. You'll learn steps you can take to start making a tangible difference and how to stay, at least relatively, sane while doing it. And you'll get all this advice from women who live and breathe what they are talking about every damn day, women who have the audacity today that Clara Lemlich had in 1909. In April 1912, Clara Lemlich argued passionately for working women's right to the vote. "We are here, and we are here to stay," she said. "Today, we are here, and we are here to stay. So, dear reader, go forth and change the world. There's an army of women who came before you, and they all have your back." Part 1. Welcome to the Resistance. Chapter 1. There's no time like the present to give all the fucks. If not now, when? Hillel the Elder. When I asked Black Lives Matter co-founder Alicia Garza what would happen if Americans didn't wake up and get active, she didn't mince words. "If we don't collectively get active in defense of safety and justice for all of us, a lot of us will reap the consequences, including death," she said. "No one is coming to save us except for us, so we might as well get to work." That's a sentiment I heard echoed by many of the activists I spoke to for this book. The time for action is now. Yesterday, really. And if you are a person who cares about your own future, the future of the people around you, and the future of your nation, it's your responsibility to roll up your metaphorical sleeves and jump into the fray. Of course, this can be easier said than done. It's scary and overwhelming to think about how much is at stake. Access to health care, abortion rights, voting rights, the physical safety of trans people when they walk down the street, the physical safety of black Americans when they interact with police, and, you know, the survival of the entire freaking earth. The first months of Donald Trump's presidency provided a litany of examples of what can happen when a white supremacist agenda makes its way into the White House. The following are just a handful. Travel bans targeting Muslim-majority countries were issued. The GOP attempted to do some combination of repealing and replacing the Affordable Care Act, which left up to 32 million people vulnerable to losing health insurance over less than 10 years. The president pulled back protections for women workers. The president touted what he labeled a military operation to identify, arrest, and deport undocumented immigrants. A guidance protecting transgender students in public schools was rescinded. A budget was proposed that cut funding for PBS, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Meals on Wheels. The president pulled the United States out of the Paris Climate Agreement. The global gag rule was drastically expanded, prohibiting any global health funding for organizations that provide or even mention abortion as an option to women. An Obama-era rule that prohibited mentally ill individuals from purchasing guns was rolled back. The president signed a measure that allows states to withhold Title X funding for family planning from clinics that provide abortions. The president issued a memo directing the Pentagon to ban transgender people from openly serving in the U.S. military. Let's play a terrifying game and try to name a few of the groups that stood to be impacted by those decisions. Trans kids, undocumented immigrants, documented immigrants, Muslim Americans, public school students, children who watch Sesame Street, poor senior citizens, artists, women who need birth control, women who need maternity care, anyone who needs health care at some point in their lives and can't afford to pay thousands of dollars every time they access it, all Americans who would prefer the United States protect its national security interests, people who are looking to spend some quality time on planet Earth. That covers a hell of a lot of people. This is a time to define the values our country stands for and to fight for those values, Tina Chen, former Chief of Staff to First Lady Michelle Obama and Executive Director of the Obama White House Council on Women and Girls, told me. Like caring for those in need, expanding social justice for all, and protecting our planet for future generations. The beauty of our democratic system is that these choices are in the hands of the people, citizens who can make their voices and their votes heard. And during those first months of Trump's presidency, we witnessed what a difference it makes when people are paying attention and taking a stand. The women's marches across the country became the largest single-day demonstration in U.S. history. People showed up en masse to protest at airports within hours of Trump's initial sweeping travel ban. Citizens came to town halls and flooded their elected officials' offices with calls, creating political roadblocks for a GOP-controlled Congress that wanted to swiftly repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Thousands of women expressed interest in running for office. Collective action makes a difference. We've seen it happen. When you are a member of a group whose basic rights and safety are generally protected, it can be easy to ignore that the rights and safety of your fellow citizens are not. This cushion of security can make it seem to some of us like politics is something that can be separated from ourselves and our lives. For some Americans, the election was a clarifying moment. For some, specifically middle and upper-class progressive white people, a long-treasured vision of this country as unified and fundamentally open-minded was dashed. It's not that our nation actually transformed overnight, though in some circles it certainly felt like it had. It's more that the fury and resentment and tribalism that had long existed within communities that felt ignored and threatened, helped along by healthy doses of xenophobia, Islamophobia, racism, and sexism, had come bubbling up to the surface and into our country's voting booths. It's far harder to ignore all the underlying inequalities that make up American society when a walking, talking, pussy-grabbing orange caricature of incompetent toxic masculinity is its face. I think a lot of silver spoons were pulled out of mouths, and now people are understanding that they can't take their happiness or their health care or the political process for granted, organizer and writer Raquel Willis told me. Of course, those silver spoons were only in the mouths of people born white and straight and cisgender and financially secure, people like me. The truth is that there were always people fighting, Raquel continued. Thinking about the most marginalized, people of color, black folks, poor folks, disabled folks, trans folks, queer folks, and women. We've been fighting. It's only now that I think people are starting to understand that the reason we haven't been more successful is because we weren't invested in the liberation of those other marginalized folks as much as we should have been. Guilty as charged. I certainly have had moments where I preferred to dissociate a little bit, to push aside the knowledge that people are hurting every day in this country, because it feels hard and confusing and scary to really sit with that understanding. Maybe you've also had those moments, or days, or weeks, or years. Set whatever you haven't done in the past aside, and get looking toward the future. Remember that guilt is a useless emotion, one that often sinks us deeper into a hole of inaction, rather than pulling us out of it and lighting a fire under our asses. Deciding that you are powerless is also useless. The important thing is that you're ready to show up now. Maybe that future includes raising money for organizations that you believe in. Maybe it includes going door to door, campaigning for someone you believe will do good if elected to office. Maybe it means making sure you're informed about local elections and that you become a more active participant in democracy. Maybe it includes showing up to protests in solidarity with communities you're not currently connected to. Maybe it includes pushing your local school district to broaden its sex education. Maybe it includes putting pressure on the education secretary to keep and enforce protections for victims of college sexual assault. Maybe it includes setting 5 minutes aside each day to call your congressperson. Maybe it includes running for office yourself. When people sit on the sidelines in our democracy and let others set the terms of political debates, then they surrender the policy decisions to the biggest corporations and billionaires who can hire armies of lawyers and lobbyists, said Senator Elizabeth Warren when I asked her why acting now is so important. In that case, our country will keep working better and better for a smaller and smaller number of people. It's up to us to make sure that doesn't happen. That us is you, dear listener. No matter who you are, there's not a moment to waste. Use your time, brilliance, money, and fire tweets for good. Chapter 2. Hey, girls, hey! Why young women's voices are so damn essential. Being a woman means growing up in a world that tells you to be quiet in a million small ways every day. The messages are subtle, of course, but omnipresent. Don't be too big. Don't be too small. Don't be too young. Don't be too old. Don't try too hard. Don't be too loud. Don't take up too much space. Be successful, but not threatening. Be beautiful, but naturally so. Buy all the things that corporations tell you will help you conform to these impossible standards, but don't make it obvious that you needed any products to achieve perfection. And while you're spinning out trying to be the thing that you think you must be to be worthwhile, the men around you are free to learn, to speak, to explore, to lead. It's easy to say that we should all just say screw that and take up space anyway. And we should. But the reality is that it's way easier said than done. Motivation and engagement take work. They take constant reaffirmation and reminding of why these fights are so damn important. When my own faith is failing me or weakening, I turn to the greatest teachers I know, other women. I ask the women I spoke to for this book why we need young women's voices in this fight. Every answer was beautiful, and I want them all printed on motivational posters to hang on my wall. Maybe an Etsy store is in my future. But instead of doing that, I decided to put them all in one place for you, dear listener. Carmen Perez, Women's March National Co-Chair. Women are the ones who are the driving forces in many of the issues that we care about. Women are at the forefront. They've always been at the forefront. It's important for us to nurture young people because young people have always led movements. When we look at SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, when we look at the Chicano movement or the American Indian movement, it was young people. And so the way in which I see change is by cultivating the leadership of youth, and specifically young women, so that they can be the agents of change in their own families and in their own communities. I see myself in a lot of the young girls that I work with, but the difference between them and myself is that I was given an opportunity and they weren't. So that's what I really try to do, give young women opportunities to have access to leadership development or civic engagement or political engagement. Marlo Thomas, award-winning actress, author, and activist. It is up to young women now to carry the fight forward, as these issues will define their lives and their children's lives. Today's young women are the ones whose reproductive rights are most dangerously under siege. They are the ones carrying student debt into a workforce that still doesn't pay them fairly in many states. And God knows, they and all young people are the ones who will be most imperiled by whatever environmental damage the planet will suffer in the next half century. But in spite of all these challenges, I feel optimistic. Because as someone who participates as much as I can in social media, I am continually inspired by the intelligence and relentlessness of today's young women warriors. They are keeping us all on the leading edge of modern feminism, and I am learning from them every day. Lucy McBath, mother of the movement, spokesperson for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, and faith outreach leader for Every Town for Gun Safety. The young women of today are the mothers of tomorrow. It's about preserving your own futures. It's about protecting your families. Young women are going to be mothers. They're going to be community leaders, and they're going to be active in their churches and community organizations. I tell young people all the time that I'm 57, but I'm out there fighting for you. We need you to fight for you. Pat Schroeder, former congresswoman. If you're going to make democracy work, you've got to work at democracy and social justice. In 2020, women in this country will have had the vote for 100 years. Equal pay, the obsession with trying to control women's reproductive rights, things like that should be over with. We should have moved on, and women should be in positions of leadership. And yet in 2017, you just see the Senate deciding there would be 13 people negotiating the GOP Senate health care bill, and they couldn't bother to put a woman senator in there. You're just seeing that every single day. We certainly have the education, we have the ability. It's never too late for equal rights. Amanda Gorman, activist and youth poet laureate of the United States. Young female and femme voices are so vital because they add more to the narrative that is often left untold, and just sociologically speaking, we also see that people who identify as women have a good capacity for collaboration, for empathy, for reaching across the aisles. And while I'll always be afraid of people using those stereotypes as a way to limit women, I think the strength of identifying as a woman, whether you're a cisgender or trans, it gives you this interesting perspective into not only patriarchy in the United States, but also other systems of oppression. One woman can tap into that as a united force, and we see an earthquake that rocks the world. Sarah McBride, National Press Secretary for the Human Rights Campaign and LGBTQ activist. I can't underscore enough the importance of young voices in these conversations. Young voices are going to be the voices that inherit this environment and are learning in our schools and are going to be entering the job force. So they have a real stake in the policy discussions that we're having. But beyond that, they're so necessary because they're incredibly effective voices for the types of progressive change we need. When they speak on political issues, they are speaking from a place of history. Young people will be the ones who write the history books of tomorrow. And elected officials, business leaders, and the everyday public, they know that. Jackie Cruz, actress and activist. All young people need to engage right now in social justice issues. They're our future, particularly women. We need to learn from a young age the importance of civil engagement, standing up for our rights, and having our voices heard. It starts as young as immigration rights activist Sophie Cruz. I mean, she's 6 years old. Gabrielle Gorman, filmmaker and Young Arts winner. I always like to refer back to this pep talk that I saw. The woman giving the talk is talking about the danger of the single story that's only heard from a particular perspective, a particular group of people. That's why female voices are so important. And to have a diverse range of female voices, people from different sexualities, people from different communities and cultures. I think it's important to recognize that intersectionality. Elizabeth Warren, United States Senator. If not you, then who? If not now, then when? We need more women to speak up and make their voices heard. We need you in this fight. Ai-Jen Poo, Director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and co-director of Caring Across Generations. Women are often talked about as a special interest group, but we are more than half of all college graduates, more than half the electorate. We are doing 70% of the caregiving work, and we are more than 70% of all consumers. So our experiences and our perspectives are more defining of the whole than ever. So our perspectives need to be at the table to design solutions that actually work. Because if you're not looking at the world through the eyes of women, you're not seeing the whole picture. Shannon Watts, founder of Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. Women are the secret sauce. Women are what make organizing go. Incorporating women's ability to be compassionate and passionate and multitask is key to winning and organizing. If you look at the front line of activism for so long, child labor laws, drunk driving, the right to vote, there are so many different areas that you can demonstrate where women have been leading the charge. Wendy Davis, former state senator and founder of Deeds Not Words. We need more women, period, in the fight for social justice, but I think we have the greatest potential lift in getting the voices of young women to be part of the conversation simply by virtue of the percentage of the population that young women occupy. By the year 2020, millennials as a whole, women and men, are going to be 40% of the eligible voters in this country. If we were able to really turn on the power that young women and young men possess, we would change the dynamic completely of what the conversation is in political contests and in policymaking. Janae Ingram, national organizer and head of logistics for Women's March. Movements have always been led by young people. I think that there is a certain impatience that comes with being young. We are the microwave generation, where everything happens in an instant. You can talk to someone halfway across the world in a click of a button. You can get your food in 5 minutes, and it's completely cooked. Everything just happens so fast. Because of that, I think that that impatience has also bled into our understanding of social injustice. We want to see change, and we are going to fight to make that happen. Young people, we can go out, and we can stand in the streets all night, like they did in Ferguson, following the shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson. We can stay out all night and do that days upon days upon days on end. The elders, their responsibility is to guide us and to engage us and to tell us how we can better strategize, what lessons they learned. Deja Fox, high school student and reproductive justice advocate. I would encourage other young women to speak their truth and share their experiences because their stories are agents of change. Young people, women, LGBTQ folks, and people of color must be at the forefront of our movements. The future leaders are those who come from diverse backgrounds, and it is time that we take that role up and defy the systematic forces that for so long have held us back. We are the future. Bob Bland, Women's March National Co-Chair. You know the phrase, "the future is female"? It's not just a phrase. It's not just a tagline to sell shirts. It is really the truth. And the reason why it's so important to have women and girls centered in leadership in all these conversations is, first of all, because it's the one thing we haven't tried. You know, patriarchy had a good run. We've been doing this for, what, a few millennia? And what have we gotten from that? We've gotten war. We've gotten competition. We've gotten capitalism brought to its most sociopathic and extreme. Women have not had the chance to take the lead, and that is why we must now. I remember when Dr. Bernice King was speaking to all of our Women's March organizers in December 2016. She quoted her mother, Coretta Scott King, and she said, "First of all, women, If the soul of the nation is to be saved, I think you must become its soul. Women must give birth to whatever the new generation of this country and this society is to become, because we are the connector of everything. Every single person on this earth has something in common with each other. It's that every single person came out of a woman. There are so many things that divide us, but that is an undeniable fact. And it's powerful that we are tasked with bringing life into this world. Alicia Garza, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Network and Special Projects Director at the National Domestic Workers Alliance. Young women's voices are needed in the fight for social justice because there's so much happening in the world right now that directly impacts women and girls. I look at the photos coming out of the White House these days, with a zillion white men sitting around a table making decisions about women's bodies, our health, and our lives, and it is completely infuriating. There are hardly any women at the table, if any at all. And then if we were to look at the racial and ethnic compositions of those rooms where decisions are being made, they are pale and male. Young women deserve to make decisions that are best for us, and there's no better time than now to get involved. Otherwise, the health care we need to have safe and healthy families, the communities we desire where children could grow up to become adults and be free of violence, will never materialize. Sarah Sophie Flicker, National Organizer for Women's March, Creative Director and Performer. Young people just get it. I definitely feel like the smartest thing I do for my activism is hang out with people younger than I am and really allow them to lead. I really enjoy their voices, and I feel like I learn new things all the time. That's just the obvious, inevitable way that progress happens. If you look at people who are real leaders, like Gloria Steinem, for example, she really knows how to listen. She really values all the younger people coming up. She does not try to tell them what's what. Tina Chen, former chief of staff to First Lady Michelle Obama and executive director of the Obama White House Council on Women and Girls. Young women are living lives of inclusion and are fighting for a future with social justice and equal opportunity for all. They are working on creative and innovative solutions. They are resilient and they are powerful. They understand the complexity of opportunity and access and what it means to have limits on that just because of identity. Most of all, it is their future that is at stake right now, and the voices of young women are critical to shaping that future. Ashley Judd, actor, author, and activist. Young people offer fresh thinking, stamina, and a necessary rowdiness. They also have a grasp of existing and emerging technologies and how they continue to revolutionize our world, and they will use them for social movements in ways that those of us who are older can't begin to envision, but will eventually embrace. What's blatantly obvious is that we currently have the largest youth cohort the planet has ever known. It is a young person's world. With Hillary Clinton recently running for president of the United States and being so eminently qualified, there are fortunately now generations of young women and girls who don't know that was novel. Relative to our nation's long history of the white man's stranglehold on power and politics. Chapter 3. On Getting Angry, The Power of Protest. On March 25, 1993, Congresswoman Pat Schroeder stood on a podium in front of hundreds of thousands of LGBTQ people and their allies in Washington, D.C. This crowd was gathered with a list of clear demands. Among them, government action on the AIDS crisis, a lift of the ban on gay people serving in the military, and legislation to protect LGBTQ families. Remember as we stand in this great capital of this wonderful nation, when we say the Pledge of Allegiance, we say with liberty and justice for all, Schroeder declared. Well, what part of all don't people understand? We mean all. The New York Times described the tone of this march, the March on Washington for Lesbian, Gay, and Bi Equal Rights and Liberation, as one of pride, of feeling part of a larger gay community and not being afraid to march down the street to proclaim it, and commented that many marchers were accompanied by small children and parents. I was one of those children. I'm not sure if this was the first protest or march I ever attended, but it's certainly the first one I can remember. I was 5 years old, and from where I was sitting, in my younger brother's stroller, being pushed by a rotating cast of my mother, my father, and my grandma, it looked joyful. A crowded downtown D.C. filled with colorful people and rainbow flags and shirtless women wearing stickers to cover their nipples. I remember being particularly curious about that. In the one photo I have from that day, I'm holding a rainbow flag in my hand, peeking out from underneath a painfully 90s neon blue hat. My grandmother is wearing a P-flag sash, and a smiling woman with a cropped haircut in the background is holding up a sign that reads, simply, lesbian rights. It's unclear how much I actually understood about what was going on that day, but something about the magic of being in a crowd unified by common purpose and love and anger made it into my subconscious. I've been to many protests and marches since that one, first as a participant and later as a journalist. And each time I remember again the magic of that collective energy I witnessed at age 5. I marched in protest of the Iraq War and in support of Planned Parenthood. I got to interview children and parents who attended Occupy Wall Street's family sleepover in 2012. I think it's good for kids to participate in democracy, mother of two Megan Davidson told me at the time. This is what democracy looks like. I got to document New York City's first marches in solidarity with Black Lives Matter. And on January 21st, 2017, I was back in Washington, D.C., witnessing history, or rather, her story, at the Women's March. Along with my coworkers, Alana, Catherine, and Damon, I spent the day weaving through the crowds, speaking to women, men, and children about why they were out there, on that day, in that place, together. Every person who took the time to talk to us had a moving reason, but one 83-year-old woman, who had shown up with her cane, three custom pink nasty old woman sweatshirt-clad girlfriends in tow, made a lasting impression. Susan had been in the protest game for decades. She had shown up for her Black brothers and sisters in the 1960s, at the height of the civil rights movement. "I marched from Selma to Montgomery," she told me, "and I truly believe in the energy and the spirit of mass protest." That date of that march, March 7th, 1965, came to be known as Bloody Sunday, for the brutal and televised police violence used against protesters on the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama. The Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, had been working to register Black voters around Selma for months and facing great resistance from the state government and law enforcement. In February of 1965, a police officer shot 26-year-old activist Jimmy Lee Jackson as he rushed over to help his mother during a peaceful civil rights demonstration. About a week later, on February 26th, Jackson died. In response, the march from Selma to Montgomery, the capital of Alabama, was planned. Many are familiar with the key male players of that march and the marches that followed. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., of course. Now Congressman John Lewis, James Bevel, Hosea Williams. But women activists were also a key driving force. Diane Nash, Amelia Boynton Robinson, Annie Lee Cooper, Viola Liuzzo, and more. For Diane Nash, who was 26 when Bloody Sunday took place, the impetus behind the march from Selma to Montgomery came earlier than 1965. Around the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, she remembered the 1963 Ku Klux Klan bombing of a Baptist church in Alabama, which resulted in the deaths of 4 young Black girls. The day the girls were murdered in the bombing at the 16th Street Baptist Church in Birmingham, then-husband James Bevel and I wrote the initial plan for what became the Selma Right to Vote movement, she told a local ABC news station in March 2015. For several years, she and James tried to convince Dr. King to join them in Alabama. Eventually, they succeeded. On that fateful Sunday, some 600 demonstrators marched through downtown Selma to the Edmund Pettus Bridge, named for a Confederate general. Halfway across, they saw a human wall of state troopers on the other side, as white locals looked on. The New York Times described what happened next. The scene in Selma resembled that in a police state. Heavily armed men attacked the marchers. Tear gas was used. Witnesses said they saw posse men using whips on the fleeing Negroes as they recrossed the bridge. If this is described as law enforcement, it is misnamed. It is nothing more nor less than race-conscious officialdom run amok. It disgraces not only the state of Alabama, but every citizen of the country in which it can happen. The video footage of this brutal altercation and the peaceful response of the protesters who were being attacked was broadcast across the nation, leading to more marches, more violence, and widespread outcry. Eventually, the protests succeeded, and the Voting Rights Act, which prohibits racial discrimination in voting and removed barriers to registration such as poll taxes and literacy tests, was signed into law by President Lyndon Johnson on August 6, 1965. Sadly, in 2013, essential parts of the VRA were gutted by the Supreme Court. While Diane is widely recognized as a leader in the civil rights movement and was immortalized in the Ava DuVernay-helmed film Selma, she has always been careful to point out that the fight for civil rights depended on a movement rather than an individual. "It took many thousands of people to make the changes that we've made," she said in 2015. "People whose names we'll never know. They'll never get credit for the sacrifices they've made, but I remember them." Public acts of resistance are effective because they grab the attention of people who aren't physically there. One person on a street corner can easily go unnoticed, or at least be tuned out. But get 50 or 500 or 5,000 or 50,000 people together, all unified around one issue, and they become a hell of a lot harder to ignore. Today's resistance is fueled by collective action, on social media, at town halls, in the streets. Collective, or at the very least coordinated, actions tend to receive media coverage, and media coverage makes it easier to hold elected officials' feet to the fire. Momentum begets momentum. But when you don't have 50,000 or even 500 people in one place, deploying your voice wisely can suffice. In an era dominated by 24/7 TV and web news coverage, as well as social media, getting your voice heard is far easier. Any girl with a Twitter or Instagram account understands that. Look no further than Deja Fox. Just days before her 17th birthday, the Tucson, Arizona teen showed up at Republican Senator Jeff Flake's April 2017 town hall with a question. "Why would you deny me the American dream if Planned Parenthood is helping me reach it?" Less than a week prior, Senator Flake had voted to allow states to block Title X family planning funding for healthcare providers that also perform abortions, such as Planned Parenthood. The Hyde Amendment already prevents federal Medicaid coverage for abortion services unless a woman's life is in danger, or in cases of rape and incest. Fox, along with many other Arizonans, showed up to speak to Flake when he returned to his home state. "I just want to state some facts," she told the senator. "I'm a young woman. You're a middle-aged man. I'm a person of color, and you're white. I come from a background of poverty, and I didn't always have parents to guide me through life. You come from privilege. I'm wondering, as a Planned Parenthood patient and someone who relies on Title X, who you are clearly not, why is it your right to take away my right to choose Planned Parenthood?" Her questions were met with huge cheers and applause from the other constituents gathered. Mere hours later, the video footage of her exchange with Senator Flake went viral, because, quite simply, Deja is a total badass. Her questions were pointed, personal, and effective, and Senator Flake responded with meaningless platitudes. "When I spoke to Deja, the week after her exchange with the senator, she told me that she's always had the spirit of activism in her life, but that she had really begun getting involved in more formal organizing when she joined the fight for comprehensive sex ed in her Arizona school district. And which organization provided mentorship and leadership trainings for her and her peers? Planned Parenthood. For Deja, the fight for sex education and birth control access felt personal. That fight was especially personal for me because, without parents, I relied on my school to provide me with factual, medically accurate, and updated information to help me make educated decisions about my future," she said. It became even more personal as I watched my peers grow as leaders in the process, and I felt a real sense of pride in having taken part in empowering them. That sense of pride and goal of empowerment is what encourages me to continue fighting. The fight against injustice will always be long and often discouraging. The only way to persist is to choose a cause you feel that your life, and the lives of others, depends on, one you can speak to from, for lack of a better, less cheesy phrase, the heart. There's a reason that thousands of people showed up to town halls across the country to express their displeasure with the GOP healthcare plans and to demand that their elected officials not try to take away healthcare from poor and middle-class people. Those stories created change. Small acts of resistance, when done by many people, are the seeds of solidarity, Deja told me. Standing united and experiencing compassion when faced with the struggles and stories of others is what makes us stronger in the face of divisive political force. Chapter 4. Dear White Ladies, a note on intersectionality. My feminism will be intersectional or it will be bullshit. Flavia Zodan, Tiger Beatdown. The first time I heard the term intersectionality, I was in college. Surprise, surprise, the lady who ended up writing about women's issues professionally spent 4 years discussing the merits of Judith Butler and bell hooks. Shocking, right? But I know that I felt relieved to finally have a word to describe a concept that felt totally integral to everything I was learning and living. At its core, intersectionality is simple, almost obvious. Groups of people are not monolithic. Our identities overlap and compound in myriad ways. Therefore, when you talk about women or the LGBTQ community, you are talking about groups of people who share some common experiences but have many more different ones. The key is that these differences impact the way that individuals experience the world and therefore the way they experience whatever particular oppression an activist or organizer is trying to combat. If you are blind to or willfully ignore these differences, it becomes impossible to create lasting and meaningful solutions. If a solution addresses only a part of the problem, it's not actually a solution at all. It's a band-aid, reserved for only a few. As gun safety activist Lucy McBath put it, you cannot focus on one issue without the intersectionality of all of the issues. It's like you have a wheel, and every issue is a spoke that ties into that wheel. Until we're able to eradicate or work on all of these kinds of issues, we'll never solve one issue, because they're all intricately connected. You might be thinking, well, duh, and you'd be right. But putting intersectionality into practice is when things get tough. There's not a social movement in history that hasn't had issues with actually advocating for the entirety of the group it purports to be fighting for. Look no further than the suffragettes, many of whom chose to prioritize white middle-class women's rights at the expense of women of color. This problematic idea of white, educated middle-class women as a universal stand-in for women continues to be an issue today. But today we are, at the very least, better equipped to confront it. In my experience, most young women already understand these concepts, or latch onto them quickly once introduced to them. They understand intersectionality and white feminism, which is more than I can say for my own teenage self. Young women today know that feminism without intersectionality is no feminism at all. Intersectionality theory was first named by law professor Kimberly Crenshaw in the 1980s to address a specific issue, the compounding and overlapping discrimination that women of color may face in the workforce, and the failure of anti-discrimination laws, which looked at race and gender discrimination as completely separate entities, rather than overlapping and compounding, to address that reality. In the more general sense, intersectionality is a lens and analytical tool through which to view the world holistically. It points to the varying and complex ways that different facets of our identities intersect, informing the oppression that we experience. A black woman is not going to experience sexism in the exact same way as a white woman. A butch, queer, Latina woman is not going to experience homophobia the same way a bisexual, femme, Asian woman does. And all of the corresponding isms and phobias ultimately serve the same common purpose, to keep most of us divided and down in order to lift up a vaunted few, aka white, straight, cisgender, able-bodied, affluent men. And it's historically been a reluctance, primarily by white, straight, cisgender, affluent women, to acknowledge these differences and intersections that has created the erasure of many women in feminist spaces. This is a reality that self-described, proud, unapologetic, queer, black, transgender woman from Augusta, Georgia, Raquel Willis, spoke about at the Women's March, nodding to the iconic "Ain't I a Woman" speech women's rights and anti-slavery activist Sojourner Truth gave at the 1851 Women's Convention in Ohio. "I want to stress the importance of us being intentional about inclusion," Willis said to the thousands gathered in D.C. "Black women, women of color, queer women, trans women, disabled women, Muslim women, and so many others are still asking many of y'all, 'Ain't I a woman?' So as we commit to build this movement of resistance and liberation, no one can be an afterthought." This idea has been key to the broadening of the feminist movement, especially in pushing white feminists to consider the many ways that race and gender interact. Because white feminism, that is, feminism by and for white women only, which doesn't consider the nuanced experiences that women have depending on their varying identities, isn't true feminism. As Crenshaw put it during a 2014 interview, "Intersectionality draws attention to invisibilities that exist in feminism, in anti-racism, in class politics. So, it takes a lot of work to consistently challenge ourselves to be attentive to aspects of power that we don't ourselves experience." The last few years have brought intersectionality solidly out of the academic realm and into the mainstream. Google searches for the term have increased pretty steadily since 2012, shooting up since December 2016, peaking between January 22nd and 28th, 2017, the week directly following the Women's March. It's no coincidence that Women's March organizers, many of whom are women of color, prioritized intersectionality in the march's platform. The policy platform addressed the gender pay gap, reproductive access, and violence against women, as well as mass incarceration, the Flint water crisis, police brutality, and the rights of LGBTQ people, sex workers, people with disabilities, immigrants, and refugees. As the authors of the platform wrote, "Our liberation is bound in each other's. We cannot fight for women's rights without fighting for racial equality and LGBTQ rights. We cannot battle Islamophobia without battling xenophobia and anti-Semitism and ableism. We rise together or we fall together." Women of color understand intersectionality because they live and breathe it every day. A lack of intersectionality within social justice movements often means that people of color are ignored, spoken over, and devalued. For those of us who don't experience racial discrimination, being aware of those intersections of identity and experience may take a bit more work. If you're white, and straight, and cisgender, and able-bodied, you may be able to check out from the struggle sometimes, a privilege that women of color simply don't have. That just means you need to listen, learn, and, as writer Flavia Zodan stresses, try. Sarah Sophie Flicker, who worked on the Women's March platform, speaks decisively to the particular responsibility that white women have to follow rather than always trying to lead in the fight for social justice. Over coffee, I asked her how women, especially white women, who are just dipping their toes into activism, can make sure that intersectionality is an integral part of that activism. Her advice was pretty simple. Listen. Linda Sarsour said something that I loved the other day, which is that people who are closest to the problem are often closest to the solution, she told me. I think a big part of intersectionality and accepting your privilege is just taking a deep breath. Take a beat before you say something. Don't suck the air out of the room. Show up for a community outside your own, but don't try to speak for them. If you have the mic, pass it on if it's someone else's story. and that also takes the pressure off of you. You don't need to know everything. Sarsour's fellow national co-chair Bob Bland stressed that as a white woman, planning the Women's March involved a huge amount of learning and listening on her part, particularly about the ugly history of racism within feminist circles. "I had only heard the term intersectional once before," Bland told me. "A lot of the phrases, a lot of the words, a lot of the quotes, a lot of the names, I didn't know any of that before planning the Women's March. And I think it's important for people to know that, not just because it's the truth, but also so that it emboldens women to know that it's okay. You need to start where you are. And if you're committed to intersectionality, and if you're committed to justice, then you can learn. As a white woman, I get an education every day from women of color, and my understanding of how best to practice intersectionality in my daily life, and especially in my work, continues to grow. I asked many of the women I interviewed for this book to tell me what intersectionality meant to them and how it played out in the work they do. I learned a lot by listening to them. Listening is key, and I wanted to share that wisdom with you, dear listeners. Here's what intersectionality means for 18 active, influential women. Deja Fox, high school student and reproductive justice advocate. Intersectionality is really what activism is all about. Our identities and experiences are unique to us, and working to appreciate that in the methods we use to resist oppression makes us more united. To appreciate the intersections of an issue like reproductive justice is to look at the larger machine of oppression and the ways it affects each of us in different ways. But what is most important about this understanding is meeting the experiences of others with compassion. Lucy McBath, mother of the movement, spokesperson for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America, and faith outreach leader for Everytown for Gun Safety. Gun violence prevention is related to systemic racism, poverty, lack of education, mass incarceration, unequal pay for equal work. You cannot work on one issue without it being directly or indirectly related or correlated to any of those issues. When you look at something such as gun violence prevention, you've got to understand the dynamics of what has helped to create gun violence. Why is there such rampant gun violence, and why is it disproportionately people of color who are affected by gun violence? It's understanding, like I said, poverty, mass incarceration, unlawful police action. You cannot focus on one issue without the intersectionality of all of the issues. Janae Ingram, national organizer and head of logistics for Women's March. Intersectionality means embracing the cross-section of the issues impacting our lives. Whether you're a black woman like me, that's my intersection, I'm black and I'm a woman, or whether you are Latina and a woman who is disabled. The cross-section is where your advocacy has to come from. When we go out into the world, when we experience life, we are experiencing these things from the perspective of all of who we are. We don't get to pick and choose, today I'm going to be black, today I'm going to be a woman. We have to encounter the world from that perspective, and the issues that we're dealing with are because of that cross-section. So our advocacy has to be focused and centered in that space. Bringing that to the table also increases the awareness that other people have about those various issues or perspectives. I have done a lot of work with the disability community. I have been a partner of the disability community in making sure that their voice is heard at the table for the civil rights community. For me, through the process of planning the Women's March, I had my own discovery of, yes, I've been an advocate. Yes, I've been an ally. Yes, I've been a partner to the disability community. But I still had an opportunity to learn when I was sitting there having these calls with members from the disability community and hearing the various issues. The way that we treat the disability community in this country is like lumping together all people of color, just assuming that what one needs, they all need. And that's not the case. All of that is to say, the intersection of our advocacy is able to inform others and educate others about things that they may not be aware of. Flavia Zodan, writer. Intersectionality is a lens through which I look at all political and social and cultural issues. I try because we all have blind spots, but what I try to do is look at everything from that intersectional lens. To me, it's a tool that you apply trying to understand any given situation. It's an exercise of thinking of the world outside yourself, outside of your own lived reality. I'm specifically thinking here of young white women, because you don't need to explain this to young women of color, who have already lived through this. For young white women, it's a matter of thinking outside their